In Frontierland, I was fascinated by a true cowboy named Eddie Adamack, who twirled lariats and pitched his homemade product, a prefab lasso that enabled youngsters to make perfect circles just like their cowboy heroes. Eddie, I discerned, was living with a woman not his wife, the 1955 equivalent of devil worship. But I didn't mind, because his patronage enabled me to learn rope tricks, including the butterfly, threading the needle, and the skip step. A few years later, after my tenure as guidebook salesman ended, perhaps at 13 I was too old, I became Eddie's trick rope demonstrator, fitting in as much work as I could around my C-average high school studies. In my mapping of the Disney territory, two places captivated me. One was Merlin's Magic Shop, just inside the Fantasyland Castle Gate, where a young and funny magician named Jim Barlow sold and demonstrated magic tricks. The other was Pepsi-Cola's Golden Horseshoe Review in Frontierland, where Wally Bogue, the first comedian I ever saw in person, plied a hilarious trade of gags and offbeat skills such as gun twirling and balloon animals, and brought the house down when he turned his wig around backward. He wowed every audience every time. The theater, built with Disneyland's dedication to craftsmanship, had a horseshoe-shaped interior adorned with lush gay 90s decor. Oak tables and chairs crowded the saloon's main floor, and a spectacular mirrored bar with a gleaming footrail ran along one side. Polished brass lamps with real flames gave off an orangey glow, and on the stage hung a plush golden curtain tied back with a thickly woven cord. A balcony lined with steer's horns looped around the interior, and customers dangled their arms and heads over the railing during the show. Four theater boxes stood on either side of the stage, where VIPs would be seated ceremoniously behind a velvet rope. Young girls in low-cut dance hall dresses served paper cups brimming with Pepsi that seemed to have an exceptionally stinging carbonated fizz, and the three-piece band made the theater jump with liveliness. In the summer, the powerful air conditioning made it a welcome icebox. The admission price, always free to everyone, made me a regular. Here I had my first lessons in performing, though I was never on stage. I absorbed Wally Bogue's timing, saying his next line in my head. When they operated on father, they opened mother's mail, and took the audience's response as though it were mine. I studied where the big laughs were, learned how Wally got the small ones, and saw tiny nuances that kept the thing alive between lines. Wally shone in these performances, and in my first shows, I tried to imitate his amiable casualness. My fantasy was that one day Wally would be sick with the flu, and a desperate stage manager would come out and ask the audience if there was an adolescent boy who could possibly fill in. Merlin's Magic Shop was the next best thing to the cheering audiences at the Golden Horseshoe. Tricks were demonstrated in front of crowds of two or three people, and 20-year-old Jim Barlow took the concept of a joke shop far beyond what the Disney brass would have officially allowed, except it was clear that the customers enjoyed his kidding. Coiled springs of snake shot out of fake peanut brittle cans, attacking the unsuspecting customer who walked through the door. Jim's greeting to browsers was, "Can I take your money? I mean help you?" After a sale, he would say loudly, "This trick is guaranteed to break before you get home." Like Wally, Jim was genuinely funny, and his broad smile and innocent blonde flat top smoothed the way for his prankster style. I loitered in the shop so often that Jim and I became buddies as I memorized his routines, and I wanted more than ever to be a magician. The paraphernalia sold in the magic store was exotic, and I was dazzled by the trick's secret mechanics. The sucker die box with its tricky false fronts and gimmick door pulls thrilled me. At home, I would peruse magic catalogs for hours. I was spellbound by the graphics of another era, unchanged since the 30s, of tubes that produce silks, water bowls that poured endlessly, and magic wands that did nothing. I dreamed of owning color-changing scarves and amazing swords that could spear the selected card when the deck was thrown into the air. I read advertising pamphlets from distant companies in Ohio that offered collapsible opera hats, pre-owned tuxedos, and white-tipped canes. I had fantasies of levitation and awesome power, and, with no Harry Potter to be compared to, my store-bought tricks could go a long way toward making me feel special. With any spare money I had, I bought tricks, memorized their accompanying standard patter, and assembled a magic show that I would perform for anyone who would watch, mostly my parents and their tolerant bridge partners. One afternoon I was in the audience at the Golden Horseshoe sipping my Pepsi and mouthing along with Wally Bogue, when I blacked out and collapsed. I remember my head striking the table. A few seconds later, I was sitting back up, but unnerved. Nobody noticed, but I reported this incident to my mother, and she called Dr. Kuznets, perhaps Orange County's only Jewish doctor, who lived next door. "What was it?" he asked. "It was a thump in my chest," I said. Tests confirmed I had a heart murmur, more spookily expressed as a prolapsed mitral valve, a mostly benign malady that was predicted to go away as I aged. It did, but it planted in me a seed of hypochondria that poisonously bloomed years later. After poor sales ended my trick-roping days, I spent a year working away from the action in the sheet-metal gray storage room of Tiki's Tropical Imports in Adventureland, where I pinned finger-piercing price tags onto straw hats. I'm sure my bloody screams alarmed the nearby dock loaders. On my infrequent trips to the actual store, I was entertained by a vibrant Biloxi-born store manager named Irene, who, I now realize, was probably the first neurotic I ever met. Her favorite saying, "Well, excuse me for living," stuck in my head. I had heard rumors of a job opening up at the magic shop, and longing to be free of the sunless warehouse, I went over and successfully applied, making that day the happiest of my life so far. I began my show business career a few days later, at age 15, in August 1960. I stood behind a counter 8 hours a day, shuffling Svengali decks, manipulating wizard decks, and mental photography cards, and performing the cups and balls trick on a rectangle of padded green felt. A few customers would gather, usually a young couple on a date or a mom and dad with kids. I tried my first jokes, all lifted from Jim's funny patter, and had my first audience that wasn't friends or family. My weekends and holidays were now spent in long hours at Disneyland, made possible by lax child labor laws and my high school, which assigned no homework. At closing time, I would stock the shelves, sweep the floor, count out the register, and then bicycle home in the dark. The magic shop purveyed such goodies as the arrow through the head and nose glasses, props I turned into professional assets later on. Posted behind the scenes, too risque for Disneyland's tourists, was a little gag postcard that had been printed in Japan. It said, "Happy Feet," and featured the outline of the bottoms of 4 feet, 2 pointed up, 2 pointed down. After I studied it for about an hour, Jim Barlow explained that it was the long-end view of a couple making love. There were 2 magic shops, the other was on Main Street, and I ran between them as necessary. In the Main Street store, there was a booth, really an alcove, where you could get your name printed in a headline. "Wanted, horse thief, your name here," and I mastered the soon-to-be-useless art of hand typesetting. The proprietor, Jim, a different Jim, laughed at me because I insisted on wearing gardening gloves while I worked with the printing press. I couldn't let the ink stain my hands. It would look unsightly when I was demonstrating cards. At the print shop, I learned my first life lesson. One day, I was particularly gloomy, and Jim asked me what the matter was. I told him my high school girlfriend, for all of 2 weeks, had broken up with me. He said, "Oh, that'll happen a lot." The knowledge that this horrid grief was simply a part of life's routine cheered me up almost instantly. Merlin's was run by Leo Benke, a fine card and coin manipulator who was the first person to let me in on the inner secrets of magic and who endorsed a strict code of practice and discipline that I took to heart. But Leo had another quality that transfixed me. He handled cards with delicacy. There was a rhythm to his movements that was mildly hypnotic. He could shuffle the deck without ever lifting it from the tabletop. After an almost invisible riffle, every card was interlaced exactly with the next, a perfect shuffle. Then with the elegance of Fred Astaire, he squared the cards by running his fingers smoothly around the edges of the deck. Leo taught me his perfect shuffle, called the Pharaoh Shuffle, which I perfected a mere 4 months later, and I squared the deck just like he did. I enjoyed making the slights imperceptible and moving my fingers around the cards with Leo's grace and ease. A magician's hands are often hiding things, and I learned that stillness can be as deceptive as motion. It was my first experience with the pleasure and subtlety of physical expression, and I became aware of the potency of movement. Because I was demonstrating tricks 8 to 12 hours a day, I got better and better. I could even duplicate the effect of trick decks with a regular deck. I was able to afford more professional equipment, including, at a price of $4.50, the Zombie, a floating silver ball that danced behind a silk scarf to bewildering effect. I put together a magic act, complete with music, that required a friend to put the needle down on a record at exactly the right moment in exactly the right groove. Jim Barlow connected me to a network of desperate Cub Scouts seeking entertainment, and the minuscule prestige from my magic shop gig enabled me to work for free or sometimes for $5 at the local Kiwanis Club. I was now performing at the hectic pace of one show every 2 or 3 months. Later in life, I wondered why the Kiwanis Club or the Rotary Club, comprised of grown men, would hire a 15-year-old boy magician to entertain at their dinners. Only one answer makes sense: out of the goodness of their hearts. Claude Plum, a suspender-wearing oddnik who, among other things, collected thousands of B-movie stills from the 1940s, wrote a mimeographed in-house newsletter for Disneyland and supplied gags for Wally Bogue. "I'm in the dark side of the cattle business. Do you rustle? Only when I wear taffeta shorts." He would lend me his copies of Robert Orban's joke books, filled with musty one-liners from other comedians' acts, but to me, they were as new as sunrise. These books were like the Bible, and I scoured them for usable passages. For $5, a major investment, I hired Claude to write some material for my floating silver ball routine. "With the advent of the space age," I squeaked, "scientists have been searching for a metal that can defy gravity." The magic shop put me in daily contact with people, and when I was 15, there was only one kind of people: girls. I have a clear memory of standing behind the counter watching a girl in shorts turn away from me and being confronted by the alarmingly pleasant side of her rear end and all its curvy virtues. My body flooded with chemistry, and the female behind was instantly added to my growing list of turn-ons, which up till then included only faces, hair, and that which I will call brassieres, because actual breasts were still unseen and never experienced. The Main Street store was run by Aldini the Magician, real name Alex Weiner, a mustachioed, tart-tongued spielmeister who taught me all the Yiddish words I know, including the invaluable tukas, meaning ass, which he used as a code word to indicate that a sexy girl had come into the shop. I did have a life outside Disneyland. I had been attending Rancho Alamitos High School, but in the fall of 1962, redistricting moved me across town to Garden Grove High School, where I was happy to discard my old personality and adopt a new one defined by the word of the day, nonconformist. Of course, the difference between my old personality and my new personality was probably imperceptible, so I was lucky to have all new classmates who would not remember my old conformist ways. On my first day of school, the student body was called together for an assembly, and this was where I saw the face of God. The Don Wash Auditorium seated 1,500 people, and its interior narrowed like a funnel to focus all eyes on its polished hardwood stage. The proscenium was framed by heavy velvet curtains, and the acoustics were, and still are, brilliant and sharp, making microphones unnecessary. I sat in the audience, looking up at the stage, surrounded by high-energy adolescent chatter. The house lights dimmed dramatically, and when the crisp, ice-blue spotlight illuminated center stage in anticipation of parting curtains and grand entrances, I knew I wanted to be up there rather than down here. When Claude Plum asked me to appear in a vaudeville show featuring Wally Bogue, coincidentally staged at this auditorium, my heart leapt. I was to perform a 5-minute act, billed as Steve Martin, Youth and Magic, in an evening show for Wally's fans. The programs appeared from the printer with the perfect prescient typo: Steve Martin, Mouth and Magic. I couldn't judge how it went, since it was my first show in front of a sizable audience, but I don't remember a standing ovation. Claude Plum appeared in the program too, but he listed his name as Clyde Prim in order to escape creditors. Years later, I ran into him working at Larry Edmonds' rare bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard. Claude was still weird and mysterious, a bit of a pigpen, still with a 1-inch stub of smoldering cigarette pursed in his lips, still collecting artifacts of 40s film noir. The daily excitement of my life at Disneyland in high school was in stark contrast to my life at home. Silent family dinners, the general taboo on free talk and opinion, my father's unpredictable temper, and the stubborn grudges I collected and held toward him meant that the family never gelled. But when I was away from home, my high school pals and I enjoyed endless conversation and laughter, and my enthusiasm for what I was doing, working at Disneyland, clowning with friends, and being swept up in the early rock and roll of AM radio made life seem joyful and limitless. When I moved out of the house at 18, I rarely called home to check up on my parents or tell them how I was doing. Why? The answer shocks me as I write it. I didn't know I was supposed to.